Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, December 7th. I'm Ray Graff. WAMC's gravitational pull has brought astronomer Bob Berman back to the show to field all of your astronomy-related inquiries. As you know, Bob is one of the best-known, most widely read astronomers in the whole wide world. He's been featured in Discover Magazine, Astronomy Magazine. He is the astronomy editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac. If you have a question about the heavens, give us a call, 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. You may also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, that number, 800-348-2551. The moon, the sky, the sun. Bob Berman coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Renowned astronomer Bob Berman is in the studio, and he is here to answer your questions about space, time, and the great beyond. Our number here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org, but again, our number, 800-348-2551. Bob has been an author for a long time. He is also featured in Discover Magazine, Astronomy Magazine. He's the editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac, Astronomy section. Bob, how you doing?
I'm good, Ray. Thanks. Good to be here.
You know, I had a look at the 2018 Astronomy section of the Farmer's Almanac. Very cool. Stuff about the moon and coming eclipses over the years. And how much of that is hands-on Bob Berman work?
Oh, it all is. The whole astronomy section.
Really? You do the whole thing?
Yep, the whole thing. Takes a while. To get each year's done. And we do them way in advance. Like it was 3 years ago, we were finished with the 2019 already.
Yeah. Well, it's easy for you. Not so easy for them to predict 2 years ahead on the weather, I would assume. But that's another story. We won't go in there.
Right.
And the only uncomfortable thing I have, and I apologize to those of our listeners who sort of follow along with astrology, it is too near the astrology section for me, the astronomy section of the Farmer's Almanac. There should be a little separation there.
I know. Well, you know how I feel about it. There's no astronomer in the world who believes in astrology, so you'll get no argument from me.
Pretty good book, though. Fun to read.
Yeah, people keep it in their bathroom, the yellow thing.
It's funny. That might be where I saw it. I'm not sure. Our number here is 800-348-2551 if you want to talk to Bob Berman. Astronomers have discovered a supersized black hole harkening back to almost the dawn of creation. It's the farthest black hole ever found. A team led by the Carnegie Observatory's Eduardo Banados reported in the journal Nature on Wednesday that the black hole lies in a quasar dating to 690 million years.
After the Big Bang?
After the Big Bang. It says of the Big Bang, but I assume that would be after the Big Bang. That means the light from the quasar has been traveling our way for more than 13 billion years. What can we learn from an old quasar?
Well, I think the main thing to take away from that is that black holes, supermassive black holes, were forming that early. I mean, shortly after stars first were formed and galaxies were formed, because this one weighs about 300 million suns. That's not the heaviest black hole. That honor goes to this giant galaxy M87 in Virgo. That has a black hole at its heart that weighs 9 billion suns.
Yikes.
Worth of mass. This is 300 million. So it's not the record for mass. It's not the, but it's the farthest away supermassive black hole. Also, for me, it was exciting because it was discovered at the observatory, the Carnegie Institution's only big observatory. This is on Las Campanas Mountain
in Chile,
where we were just there. We bring a group of people there every single year.
So this is where you go every year.
Yes.
When you bring your groups, you go to this spot.
Exactly.
We go there. So what's so special about this spot?
Well, other than that, it's up at 8,000 feet, and you have a beautiful view of the Atacama Desert in all directions. And we've spent the day before that point in the Atacama Desert, all sorts of cool things there. But then this is a major research center, and we get the royal treatment because there's no visitor center there. There's no little gift shop. This is just my connections with the director.
And so you know Eduardo.
No, I don't know. This is a visiting astronomer that made this discovery.
Ah.
But the people who run it, who are there all the time, and we see the shop where the mirrors are taken out and re-illuminized, and the amazing discoveries, like that's where the supernova of 1987, the first naked eye supernova in 400 years, was discovered, right there. So it's great to be there. Then that night, we actually bus every member of our tour to another mountaintop to use a telescope. We don't use that one, but we have a private observatory that we ourselves use for two nights to look at the most amazing things under the finest skies I've ever seen on Earth. It's so bright that we see our shadows by the Milky Way.
Wow, and I assume you're going back next year.
Yeah, we're going in March.
Oh, really? And how do people find out more about that?
Oh, yeah. You know, I'd love to have more people from our area come. Yeah, you can find out specialinteresttours.com.
Specialinteresttours.com.
You'll see the place to click and get information.
Oh, that's
on
cool.
It. And yeah, join us. It's just,
I don't know.
So great. I mean, that's the least of it. You really should come with the family.
I won't.
They'd love it.
I'm going to watch it on TV.
No, the only bad thing is the long flight to get down to Chile. But once you're there, every hour is amazing. The stuff we do, the nature.
How long
stuff.
Is the flight?
Oh, it's forever. It really is forever.
Okay. Well,
especially if we have to change planes in Lima, which sometimes we do in Peru.
A long flight with my children would get everyone off. No one would ever go on a Bob Bourbon tour again, I promise you. So a quasar is what they've seen, and it's dating to 690 million years after the Big Bang. What is exactly a quasar? Is this just all the stuff that's accreting around a black hole and shining very brightly, or is it an actual object?
A quasar is like a very active core of a galaxy, so active that new stars are forming, supernovas are forming, and it's the kind of activity you don't have in the sleepier parts of the universe, or that you don't have these days. You had them back in the early parts of the universe. That's why the only quasars we see are far away, not because they're far away, but because they're long ago. Far away means long ago.
Right.
So only the early universe had quasars, and therefore you don't see them around us because we don't see them near us in time. They're from long ago.
And they're very energetic.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Are they related to those very rapid pulse, brief duration radio waves that they've been catching?
Not the pulsars, no, because these are actually more stuff going on than happens in a pulsar. They're really the most energetic, point-like sources of light, and they're all very distant. So finding now a supermassive black hole in a quasar shows us that, wow, these violent things were happening almost from the get-go when the universe was really young.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Bob Bourbon is our guest, and let's take a call or two before the first break. Andy in Kingston. Andy, you're on.
Hi. I live on an east-west street, so I can tell what is north and what is south. And I go out, I walk my dog sometimes, like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I look up to the south, and there's Orion. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And to the north is the Big Dipper.
Right, exactly.
And where's the Little Dipper?
Little Dipper's harder to see. It's because it's really much fainter than the Big Dipper is, but if you follow the bowl stars of the Big Dipper, the two bright stars that form the end of the bowl,
yeah,
they point downward to the end of the Little Dipper.
Oh, really?
The star at the end of the Little Dipper is the North Star, Polaris, and that's what they point to. So that's how
you
that's
look
the best
at the
way
end of what? The end stars?
The end stars of the Big Dipper, the ones that form the end of the bowl of the Little, you know, the Big Dipper has a handle. And then it's got four stars of the bowl. Well, the two stars of the bowl that are farthest from the handle, in other words, the very end of the Big Dipper's bowl, especially at that hour when you're walking your dog after midnight. It'll be earlier in the night once you get to February and March. But right now, you're right. It's midnight, 1, 2, 3, 4 in the morning. The Big Dipper's high overhead. And those stars that are all the way at the end of it, on the right side of it, wait a bit. That hour, it's pointing left side of it. Actually, at that hour, the ones at the end of the bowl,
the outer edge of the bowl,
point downward. Follow them to the first medium bright star, and that's the Polaris, which is at the end of the handle of the little difference.
There you go. Andy, thanks for the call. Tell me about Polaris. Sort of a mythological, a big star mythologically.
And as it deserves to be, people who are pointed it out often say, well, that's not very bright. I thought the North Star was the brightest star. And because people don't get that. What makes it special is not its brightness. It's actually the 46th brightest star in the sky. It's medium bright. Is that it's the only star that doesn't move. So that come back an hour later, all the other stars and constellations have risen or set or shifted, changed position, but not Polaris. Come back a year later, or when you're old, or when your kids are old, and it's still in that same spot.
Well, how can that
in the sky? Because our axis of rotation points to it. So as Earth spins, the axis points that way. And in fact, because of that, it's straight up from the North Pole.
Brilliant.
And because of that, it's right on the northern horizon from the equator. So, in other words, its height always equals your latitude. So if your latitude here in Albany is around 42, 43 degrees, it would be 43 degrees high.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And who figured that out?
Oh, yeah. Well, the ancients used that for navigating on ships. That you can only, the height of Polaris is always going to be equal to your latitude.
You know,
yeah.
Bob, talking to you is like reading the Farmer's Almanac. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, the great one, our astronomer expert, is here to answer your questions. 800-348-2551. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from Vermont Coffee Company, offering slow-roasted organic coffee in the brown paper bag at local grocery stores. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends. George Heigl Antiques, Ballston Spa, New York, offering estate sale services including management, appraisals, and evaluations for individuals, families, and businesses. 518-396-7974. The Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, working on land protection projects that safeguard the water quality of Lake George. Hiking maps, public events, and more at lglc.org. Interactive Media Consulting, a team of online market strategists providing websites, branding, and digital marketing to the Capital Region and beyond since 1996. imediaconsult.com. And from Rick Orlando's New World Home Cooking Company Kitchen and Bar, Sogrenies. Cooking local, sustainable, and global comfort food, dinner 7 days, and Sunday buffet brunch. NewWorldHomeCooking.com.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here, joined today by astronomer Bob Berman. Our number is 800-348-2551, or the email is voxpop@wamc.org. And Bob, before we get back to the phones, a couple of emails here. This one's from our buddy Joe, who writes, I saw two bright lights last night east of Berkshires, suspecting the space station and a satellite, one tracked north to south, the other south to north. Definitely not commercial aircraft.
Well, whenever you see a satellite-looking thing, a dot that is kind of starish in brightness, moving north to south or south to north, you should think one thing, spy satellite.
Really?
Because that's the orbit favored by spy satellites.
Polar orbit?
Polar orbit. Exactly. So they're typically up 500-600 miles, which gives them a path across the sky, which will take them completely across the sky in about 2 minutes. So if it's much faster than that, you're seeing something else. If it's much slower than that, you're seeing something else. But something that crosses the sky at about that speed, it's moving south to north and north to south. You're pretty sure that while you're watching it, it's watching you,
those
too.
Are the only things in polar orbit?
No, those are the main ones. The weather satellites tend to be geostationary, so they're up at 11,000 miles and take one whole day to cross the sky. They're not stationary because they're not up at 22,300 miles, but you're too slow to, and they're too far to see, too, because 11,000 miles, they're too dim.
Oh, very interesting. It must take a great deal of power to keep a low Earth orbit polar orbiting satellite up there only 500 or 600 miles up.
Yeah, but once you're in orbit, it's inertia.
Even that low?
Yeah.
There's no drag?
No. Well, no. Drag is below about 220 miles.
Oh, so 500 miles up, you're all right.
It's fine.
This one's from Lewis. Do we know what perturbed the recent interstellar asteroid to nudge it through the Milky Way? Where is it headed now?
I don't know where it's headed now, but it's rare to have a space object, meteoroid, asteroid, that's not part of our solar system, that has a path that's not tied in with the sun. That's really, really rare to see. And so that's what made it exciting. And where is it going? It's sort of like saying, where are the Voyagers going? Once you're out of here, you've got the whole galaxy ahead of you.
And it's already past us.
And it's already past us, yes.
Now, there were pictures, and I assume these were artist depictions of this thing. Could they get a close-up picture that showed the cigar-shaped?
Yeah, no, because it was not that close to us.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, that's right.
And they also said, this one is red. How do they know?
Well, through multiple exposures through different filters, you can see if it's brighter in one of the primary colors than the others.
Okay. Yeah. This one is from Aaron, who says, howdy, I'm thinking about heading to Iceland for a ski trip in March and wanted to be sure I'd get to see the Aurora Borealis. Will it be visible in Iceland that time of the year? And would it be best to visit when there is little or no moon in order to get the best view of the Aurora? And that's from Aaron.
Yeah, definitely a little bit of moon is good. You don't want to go on the night of the full moon. As to whether or not you'll see it or not, on our tours, again, specialinteresttours.com, if you join us to Alaska, or at least find out about it, you'll see that the reason the Alaska tours are better, in my
than
opinion,
than Iceland,
is because both places do get them. They're both over the glowing oval that surrounds the Earth's magnetic field, and so both places get auroras. But Iceland is cloudy most nights, and central Alaska is clear most nights.
Oh, interesting.
So you don't want to spend all the money and go there and have overcast. We had somebody who's a refugee from an Iceland trip a few years ago who said he was there a week and had overcast every single night. We felt sorry for the guy. Usually we'll get a cloudy night once a week. So that becomes like a real factor.
You know, you're setting yourself up for a major blow from fate because the next time you go, now that you've bragged about the weather, Bob will have 7 nights of clouds.
Oh, I hope not. Don't even say that.
And the fickle finger of fate, my friend. Let's go back to the phones at 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. Rex in Schenectady. Rex, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to ask you what you thought about the future of space travel and traveling at light speed. Or beyond light speed?
Well, two different questions. Space travel, do you mean manned space travel?
Manned and unmanned, just the incremental steps we're going to have to take to get there.
And where is there in this question? Where would there be? Where would you like to go?
Well, I'm already thinking outside of our solar system, but even just to get around ours.
Well, two very different things.
A solar society where we're outposts on Europa, stuff like that.
Okay, well now, you see, Europa has a problem, and that is radiation, because I happen to know this because I was just writing an article about it, so I could quote the exact number, that on the surface of frozen Europa, standing on the ice, an astronaut would get 540 rems of radiation per hour. Now, the fatal dose is about twice that.
Yeah.
And even 540 would be fatal to some. So you'd have lethal radiation in about 2 hours.
So you wear a tinfoil hat, right?
So you don't want to go to Europa. So where else would you go? Caller?
Rex.
Is that radiation coming from the sun or from Jupiter?
It's coming from, in the case of Jupiter, Jupiter's fierce magnetosphere holds on to solar particles and accelerates them, and Jupiter considerably adds to the radiation flux that you'd normally get from the sun and from deep space objects, because the worst cosmic rays come from supernovae elsewhere in the universe.
How about the moons of Saturn?
Well, again, which ones? We don't want to go to Titan because it's too cold on the surface, even though its nitrogen atmosphere is sort of nice. The others have no atmosphere at all. So there's but you know, the general question our caller is asking is manned space travel, and there's always two ways to look at that. First, you can get to places and do a lot more science at a tiny fraction of the cost, as we did with Galileo and Cassini and Voyager and all the other craft. If it's manned, there's expense and there's risk. And I'm not sure how the public will react when the first astronaut, you know, is killed by radiation or some other or just gets, you know, God forbid, the woman gets breast cancer and can't get a surgery because of where she is. So, you know, there's always two ways to look at it. And, you know, whether it's worth the money or whether it's worth the risk to do that. Now, your other question is about light speed travel. As you know, you can never even get close to the speed of light because of this weird thing that happens that Einstein told us
about. Infinite density.
Exactly. Well, infinite mass, in any case, your actual weight, your actual mass increases. And at first it's very slow, but once you reach half the speed of light, once you reach 75% of the speed of light, you're close to doubling it. And I have the figure for 99.9999999, seven nines after the 99% of the speed of light. Your mass at that point is 22,360 times increased.
Wow.
So you weigh 22,000 times more than you did when you started off. And the energy your rockets would need to push you just a tiny bit faster would be prohibitive, would be exorbitant.
Yeah.
So the mass increase is a real problem. And at the speed of light, it's infinite. So you cannot reach the speed of light, but you don't have to because of time dilation. Fortunately, your time passage at 99.9999999% of the speed of light, your time passes 22,360 times slower, so that even though the rest of Earth has aged, let's say, 20,000 years, you've only experienced 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're still alive, and you could reach the center of the galaxy. That's the example I'm using, because that's how far it is, about 25,000 light years. You could actually get there and come back in 2 years, but there's no getting around the fact that Earth and everyone on it has aged 50,000 years
right.
at the same time, and there's probably no welcoming committee
for
you.
It's like the Planet of the Apes.
That's right. They you know, everything would have changed. And we're not just talking about whether bell bottoms would be in
right.
or out. You know, your jokes wouldn't get a laugh. Well,
they rarely do.
You know, you'd be lucky if they didn't throw you into a zoo or lock you up or stuff.
You blew it up. You dirty. Charlton Heston, right?
Right. No.
This business about increasing mass with speed fascinates me. First of all, what is the ratio? How does one calculate that? How did Einstein do it?
Yeah, it's a graph that goes up steeply with the change, so that there's very little at first at all, until it gets so bad that, you know, that it becomes impossible. You know, Roberto Duran had that comment.
No famous. Moss.
Yeah, he
so
hated the idea.
If I was in an SR-71 Blackbird going 2,400 miles an hour and I had a one-pound block of wood, it would not appreciably be a heavier block of wood at 2,400 miles an hour.
No. But nonetheless, with an atomic clock, you could tell the difference in your passage of time between that and the surface. And the astronauts on the moon would have a different passage of time than Earth. But we're talking about measurable only in fractions of a second.
All right, my head hurts now. Let's go back to the phones. Heather in Windsor, Massachusetts. Heather, you're on with Bob Berman.
Hi. I have a question about the aurora borealis. If there is more carbon in the atmosphere, will that affect the way that we perceive the aurora?
No, fortunately, because the atmosphere's transparency is not being affected by increased CO2 at all. And the aurora, which fortunately we even get around here in upstate New York and western New England, people probably remember nice displays. We had a good one in the fall of 2000, another one in the fall of 2001. We had an all-sky aurora here on March 13th, 1989.
Oh, yeah.
So we get occasionally, you know, great displays. Of course, I mean, if you want one with colors and with shapes and motion and all the rest, you know, come to Alaska, and those are guaranteed there.
Right.
But if you're patient, we get them right here.
Okay, and the next time it happens in our neighborhood, I'll charge you very little. If you can bring the tour right to my backyard, $300-$400 will be good.
But you're not in a dark place with the skies.
Not at all. Not at all. Yeah. But still, we'll serve drinks. It'll be fun. Let's go over to Janice in Saratoga Springs. Janice.
Yes, hi. I have a weird rock that I found on the shore of Saginaw Reservoir.
Cool.
And when I Googled it, it to me looks like the stuff they show from outer space, meteorites, or whatever. Mm-hmm. How do we find out? Like, who do we show it to? Where do we take it? I tried calling the Schenectady Planetarium, and they never called me back. I just left a message with a question, and nobody got back to me.
Well, now that you've shamed them, I'm sure they'll call you back.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, some museums have people who are expert in this and who can tell. And I can sort of tell, even though the you know, geology is not, you know, my training here. I will tell you this, that a lot of rocks that people think are a meteoric are usually not. In the entire history of New York State, for example, I happen to know 12 meteors have been found in the 300 and whatever year history of New York State. So they're extremely rare. But here's what they would look like if it was a real meteorite. Number one, almost certainly a magnet would pull on it. So first try that. See if a magnet will pull on it. If your magnet will not pull on it, it's probably not a meteorite. Hmm. Number two, almost all meteorites are black or very dark. Number three, they're usually a lot heavier than you'd think that they would look. People often think that industrial slag, they mistake that for a meteorite. But the classic meteorite thing with like deep, sharp-edged pockmarks are not usually meteorites. Meteorites usually have more gentle indentations. And here's a real giveaway, a thing called regmaglypts. It's a hard word. I mean, it ends with G-L-Y-P-T. It's kind of a Scrabble type thing. Right. Regmaglypts, also called thumbprints. And here's what they look like. That if the sample you have was made of clay, soft clay, and you stuck your thumb into it and pushed, you'd see features. And ask yourself whether the rock you have has features that look like a thumb pushing into soft clay. That's almost a sure sign of a meteorite.
Interesting.
And most meteorites have these thumbprints or regmaglyphs.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, cool. Yeah, to be honest with you, when they built Sagandaga, they did a lot of burning. And I thought, well, maybe just something got hot, like you're saying, you know, industrial waste stuff. Out of a steel furnace or you know, iron place.
Yep.
I don't know. That's kind of what I thought, but I've always wanted to ask, and I never know who to ask.
Yeah,
so
some museums can test it, and there are sites online that will let you send it in for testing, often for a small fee. But remember, since only 12 have been found in our state's history, you would be the 13th.
That doesn't mean it couldn't happen.
Right.
All right, well, good luck, Janice. Let us know if you actually have one. That is is cool.
That's cool.
Does it, because it generally will have magnetism, will it have a magnetic signature that will tell the expert, okay, this is not from Earth. This magnetic signature is not from Earth.
No, that's a great question, though. The real thing that tells us it's not from Earth is to examine the isotopic ratio of a meteorite. Should I explain what that means?
Well, why not? I have time.
We're all breathing oxygen, of course. It makes up about 20% of the air we're breathing. But oxygen comes in three flavors, three varieties, depending upon how many neutrons are in the atom. Every oxygen atom has to have 8 protons. That's what makes it oxygen.
Yeah.
But it also has 8 neutrons for a total of 16 nucleons. But one out of 500 has an extra neutron. So we call that O17. And one out of 2,000 oxygen atoms in our atmosphere, or in rocks that contain oxygen, which is almost all rocks, have 2 extra neutrons, and we call that O18. Okay, so that's the ratio in the ocean water, in the rocks, everywhere on Earth. We've got that ratio. But listen to this. On the asteroid Vesta, which has sent a few meteorites towards Earth, there is a slightly higher ratio of these kind of off-brand isotopes. And on Mars, where we have about a dozen samples of Martian rocks, like that famous one that hit the Antarctic some years back, ALH84001, there is the opposite. There's a higher ratio. So Vesta has a low ratio, Mars has a higher ratio, and every celestial body, like a fingerprint, has its own distinctive ratio of oxygen isotopes. So this is a long-winded way of answering your question, Ray, that's how you tell whether a rock came from another place and where it came from, by examining the ratio of oxygen isotopes.
Very interesting. Over to Dan in Dalton, Massachusetts. Dan, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a quick one about the relationship between the Big Dipper and Polaris, and I guess all the other stars is, how often does the Big Dipper go around the North Star?
Every 23 hours, 56 minutes, and 4.1 seconds.
Show off.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thanks a lot. Another satisfied customer here on Vox Pop. Bob Berman is our guest. 800-348-2551.
Because you know what happened? I'm a moron with names, and from the time I was a kid, I always remembered numbers readily, and I memorized everything that interested me. So in a case like that, it's been in my head for 40 years, and then finally someone will ask me, well, how long does it take Mars to turn on its axis? And then I can say, and I've waited 40 years for this, 24 hours, 37 minutes, and 23 seconds.
Do you feel that once you say once you could forget it?
Well,
now I've used it. I've done that.
Yes, at least it shows it wasn't a total waste of time.
Let's take a break. Bob Berman is our guest. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be back with the home stretch and your calls coming up.
Support for WAMC comes from the Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. Colby Attorney's Service, document filing, document and information retrieval, and other services, including legal publishing and corporate record searches. ColbyService.com. Edgar Bosick, Certified Financial Planner, Private Financial Design, South Hadley. Your life, your plan, your portfolio. PrivateFinancialDesign.com. Securities through Cambridge Investment Research, member FINRA and SIPC. Boyden & Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, offering lawn and garden equipment, parts, and service to customers throughout western Massachusetts. A family-owned business for over 50 years. BoydenAndPerrin.com. And from Jay's Art Shop, downtown Bennington, Vermont, featuring art supplies, custom picture framing, art gallery, cards, gifts, and fashion apparel. 45 years in business, jaysartshop.com.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here with you at 2:40 on a Thursday afternoon. Bob Berman is our guest. Always nice to have Bob here in the studio to talk about astronomy. And the number is 800-348-2551. And who has been waiting longest? Oh, my heavens. Cynthia in Highlands, North Carolina. Cynthia, you're on.
Great. Bob, I've really enjoyed the program, by the way. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I have a question for Bob. I read in the Farmer's Almanac some years ago that one way that they are able to predict weather is by using sunspots and sun activity. And I just can't figure out how on earth that could predict weather a year or more in advance.
Cynthia, this is so funny. I was reading the Farmer's Almanac last week and read that exact same passage. And it does make some sense as far as sunspots. You had in the 1600s, the Maunder minimum with no sunspots, and it got very cold. So he was on to something. But, Bob, take it from here.
Well, I'm in an uncomfortable position. Being the astronomy editor of the Almanac, I have nothing to do with predicting the weather or those pages. A lot of people buy the Almanac for those pages of what this winter will be like, what the next spring will be like. I have nothing to do with that. Do I even believe that the Farmer's Almanac or anyone can predict the weather 2 years in advance? Because that's when we do it and we put it out. I don't think I can even answer that now. I could get fired.
All right, then don't answer that.
So I won't even answer that.
But the sunspots, quickly explain how they might affect the overall temperature.
They do, because when we have more sunspots, it tends to let the weather get warmer, because there's more energy, especially the ultraviolet. There's actually more energy. There's a little brightening of the sun, especially in the UV, and that apparently affects the atmosphere, especially the stratosphere, in a complex series of ways, and then it affects the oceans. However, that's a rough 11-year cycle. So when you look at the cycles of the sun, you'll see, except when there's strange things, which just happened, actually, where the newest sunspot cycle, number 24, began 2 years later than it was supposed to.
We had flat lines.
The previous minimum was lower than we'd ever seen in our lives. I mean, it's been a century since the sun has been acting this strangely. And the sunspot maximum we just had on cycle 24 was wimpy. It wasn't the normal maximum. But still, with a rough 11-year periodicity, you can sort of see one big influence for our weather. But what about just in a 2-year cycle? You know, can you? But no, the Farmer's Almanac, the old Farmer's Almanac, we're talking about the real one, which is called the Old Farmer's Almanac, uses a formula. And we used to have this kind of elderly solar expert guy who used it as a way of predicting weather, and that's what's still used. It's kind of like a secret sauce.
It's a secret sauce, and they explain it a little bit, but very vaguely.
Can I just have a quick follow-up?
Sure.
How long does it take that sunspot or any activity on the sun to affect the Earth?
Love it.
Well, if the sunspot is very active, for example, sunspots correlate with storms on the sun, we can actually have effects 8 minutes later.
So if there's a coronal mass ejection, it takes 8 minutes?
It takes 8 minutes for the faster stuff. For example, the light, the electromagnetic portion of it. But the sun also emits particles, as much as a billion tons of mass.
Is the solar wind?
Yeah, like a blast. It's like the solar wind, but far more powerful. And that typically takes 3 or 4 days to get here. But in a powerful sunspot with a coronal mass ejection, a CME, it can get here in as little as a single day. And then there can be immediate effects. So we had that in 1859. We had that in 1921, where even operators of telegraphs were thrown off their seats by getting electrical shocks from the electricity that was created by the solar storm and that went along the electric lines. And the New York Railroad had a building burned down because of a similar effect in 1921.
And this is the Carrington effect?
Yeah, exactly.
You wrote an article about this for the 2000.
Old Farmer's Almanac. It'll be in the 2019 Old Farmer's Almanac. We'll talk about this very issue in a multi-page article.
Cynthia, thanks so much for the call. And, of course, military and infrastructure people very concerned about EMP because you can simulate this very effectively by detonating a nuclear weapon up in the air,
exactly,
up in the atmosphere.
And RF, which means radio frequency effects, so that commercial jetliners flying polar routes lose their ability to communicate with the rest of the world, and which
during
is
an EMP or a
yes
or a
during
CME.
A coronal mass ejection. So they have to change. Plus, people get more radiation.
Yeah,
on these flights, so they actually have to reroute the flight to a longer route, which costs the airline money and costs, you know, it's inconvenient. But there's definite and satellites get fried. Their electronics get fried. We lost a few the last time this happened a few years ago. We had the Halloween storm that cost us 2 satellites.
And, of course, the most visible effect for those who have seen this is you'll get the odd power outage. It'll cause overloads and vast areas can be without power.
Absolutely. Happened that March 13th, 1989 event threw one quarter of Canada into blackness.
Indeed. All right. Over to line 2 and Grant in New Paltz. Grant, you're on.
Hi. Thank you. And great show.
Thank you.
I wondered if Bob could talk a little bit about the Schumann harmonic frequency and, you know, what it is. I'm not sure about what it is. I've heard of somebody who makes a device that apparently resonates with it as a kind of a radio device.
Schumann harmonic frequency.
Might have beneficial effects.
That's not in my brain pan right now.
You don't want to know something, Grant? The truth of the matter is most guests who are on this program will have a device or a laptop or something with them. Bob never does that. He brings a pen, he borrows a piece of paper, and that's all the rest is in his head. So
Yes. And so you'll have to remind me what this is. I've got that. That does not ring a bell. Schumann
harmonic.
No. What? Tell me about it.
I'm actually not even sure. I looked it up. I Googled it, and it was something about a planetary, the harmonics between certain planets, possibly the moon, and I even couldn't figure it out. So I thought, let me check this
Well, maybe
out.
We'll do that for homework for the
yeah,
next one.
Yeah, I'll look it up. Okay. It sounds like pseudoscience. If you're talking about harmonics between planets, now it's starting to sound like somebody's idea that may be pseudoscientific.
All right,
but I'll look into it.
Okay.
Yeah, good.
We'll not cast aspersions until Bob has had a chance to check it out. But, Grant, thank you very much for the call. And over we go to Jim in Lanesboro, Massachusetts. Jim, you're on.
Thank you. I was just wondering if you could explain how our moon formed. Was it an asteroid collision or just anything you could
offer? Yeah. Well, we think so. I mean, that's now most widely believed that a object the size of Mars, we've even given it a name, it's called Theia.
Okay.
Slammed into us very early on in our life. We're talking about probably within 100 million years of when Earth was formed. We used to think it was a glancing blow. Now it's believed that it was a head-on blow at about 7.5 miles per second.
Oh, boy.
And this is what we have to explain. We've got the strangest moon in the whole solar system, out of the 166 moons or so, major moons we're talking about. Ours is the only one that doesn't orbit our equator. Instead, it orbits us in the same flat plane as all the planets go around the sun. It ignores our 23.5-degree tilt. Jupiter's moons don't do that. You know, all these big moons, they go precisely around Jupiter's equator. Titan and Rhea and Iapetus and Hyperion and Saturn, they go around Saturn's ring plane, which is its equator. Just our moon doesn't. So any origin has to account for that. And the origin has to account for something we learned from the Apollo era, that what Ray and I were talking about, the isotopic ratio of oxygen on the moon, that is the ratio between the most common kind of oxygen, O16, with the rare kinds, O17 and 18, which are so different on other celestial bodies on the moon, it's the same as Earth's, at least to one part in 50,000.
So it came from us.
So, it's even weirder. Yes, not only did it come from us, but where was Theia's contribution? If we had a head-on collision that created the moon, and then stuff was flung into the air, into orbit, that coalesced to form the moon, which we still believe, Theia should have contributed at least half of that stuff. Why is the isotopic ratio on the moon essentially a match for Earth? Where is Theia's contribution? So you don't hear this in cocktail parties, but astronomers have been driven crazy by this. And some are saying, for example, well, maybe Theia formed in the same part of the solar system that Earth did, and so it had the same oxygen ratio as Earth, and therefore that would explain it. But
why not?
And maybe that's the truth. So anyway, you've already gotten the bottom line here, that this collision between these objects, Theia and Earth in the early days, eventually cooled down to form the moon. And that would explain why the material was flung out in the same plane of the solar system and not with Earth's tilt, why it ignored our tilt. And that would explain, maybe, why the oxygen isotopic ratios of O16 to 17 and 18 are the way they are.
Why would it explain why the moon rings like a bell when you strike it?
That's a different issue. That's a cool thing, too. It just shows that the core, which may have been molten early on during those hot days shortly after its birth, has now cooled down so that it's crystalline. So the moon, unlike Earth, has a solid core, and therefore something that strikes the surface can have shockwaves that resonate completely through the moon and back to the other side. The moon's only 2,160 miles in diameter, so a quarter of hour. So waves go right through the moon and out, and then back and forth and back and forth, and that's why the moon has reverberated like a giant gong for up to 2.5 hours after it's struck by a giant meteor or, during the Apollo program, a unneeded component of the spacecraft.
So you're sure it's not a hollowed artificial satellite?
Well, it could be. Maybe it's hollow inside, and there's a race of monkey people.
You see, now we're getting somewhere. Jim in North Pownell, Vermont. Jim, you're on.
Hey, Ray.
Hi.
Hi, Bob.
Hi.
I need to tell you that I'm going to make you jealous.
All right.
I am holding in my hand a stony iron meteorite that is a little bit smaller than a baseball and weighs over 1.5 pounds, and it was certified by my prof when I was studying earth science at Western Connecticut State College.
How did you obtain it? Where did you get it?
I found it in Squanch Pond State Park in New Fairfield, Connecticut,
sure.
around 1966.
Cool.
And it sits on my shelf, and people admire it.
That's neat.
Well, then you're the first human being I've ever met or spoken to who has found a meteorite. That's great for you. I mean, for me, the skeptical side of me would demand that you have it analyzed further, not just by a friendly professor, but by an actual lab and have it certified. However, let's just accept what you say. Still, that's amazing, and you know, it's going to change what I tell future people. When instead of saying, it's impossible, I'd have to say, well, one person it appears to have found.
Jim, were you scuba diving?
It's roughly the size of baseball. It weighs over a pound and a half. And it is magnetic. And Don Graff said that, yes, I was right. It is a meteorite.
Jim, how did you find it, though, at the bottom of Squanch Pond? Were you swimming down there?
No. I was just walking along in the state park and picked it up.
Oh, I see. It wasn't
now,
in the water.
Tell me, does it have regmaglyphs?
Yes.
Okay, well, regmaglyphs are a pretty darn good sign of a meteorite.
Oh, that's great. Congratulations on that one, Jim. Over to Matthew in Athens. Matthew, you're on.
Hi. I just wanted to find out if there's any place in northeastern Canada that would be good for viewing the aurora. Obviously, I live close to the radio station, so Alaska's a little further away than I would like to travel at this point. So,
here's what you want. There's a surrounding our North Magnetic Pole near Ellesmere Island is a glowing donut that on just about every night of the year has a glow to it, and every aurora is a section of that donut. So, at times of great solar activity, the donut expands in width; it becomes a fatter donut. And it heads south, so it becomes like a bigger donut, so it heads right. further away from the magnetic pole. So anytime you can be under that, that's when you're most likely going to see them. So go online, see a plot of the magnetic oval, the auroral oval, compare that to where you plan to go in Canada, and then you'll immediately see whether you're in a likely or less likely place. Now, when you say northeastern Canada, you mean around Hudson's Bay somewhere?
Yeah. You know, something within driving distance where my wife and I could drive up, get a hotel room.
Do they even have do they have roads up there?
Well, I don't know.
They take a blimp.
The birds, yeah, I haven't gone that far north in Canada.
All right.
But someplace, you know, on this side of the continent.
All right. Well, certainly check ahead of time and see what the University of Alaska at Fairbanks, what their aurora forecast is. They will
How
issue,
accurate is that?
They're quite accurate.
Yeah.
They issue forecasts based on solar activity going about a week out into the future.
Okay.
And that's a good thing. And if you see a level, it's always given a number. If you see a level 3 or better, especially a 4 coming up on the time that you intend to be there, then I think you're likely to see one. Despite you not being in the better part of Canada, which would be the northwest part of Canada, not the northeast.
In general, head north and head for darkness.
Yeah. That's good.
Do the auroras, the northern lights mirror the southern lights?
They do.
Why?
Every little section, because the auroral oval that goes around the south magnetic pole, which unfortunately is over no land anywhere. You'd find that to the west of Australia, to the southwest of Australia, every little section is a mirror image of what they have.
Huh.
So that the people at the University of Alaska, for example, Neil Brown, one of the experts, showed me some pictures that they took about 20 years ago showing the aurora around them. And at that same minute, researchers in the Antarctic were, he showed me a photograph that is the mirror image of that was seen at the same moment. It only takes about an eighth of a second for the electrons to make the trip from pole to pole, so they will produce, the solar activity will produce a mirror image, yes.
Did you see that on Jupiter they have detected some evidence that, in fact, they don't mirror one another?
Oh, no, I didn't. That's fascinating.
That was recently I saw that.
Huh.
And that's, explain that if you, well, we're out of time. You can explain it next time.
Wow.
Bob Berman, thanks for being here. Once again, if somebody's interested in the tours, what's the website?
It's specialinteresttours.com.
Bob Berman, thanks for being here. Support comes from HMT at the Spa Little Theater, presenting Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, weekends December 8th through December 17th at Saratoga Spa State Park, homemadetheater.org. Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York, specializing in distinctive eyewear, including Zenka from Paris and Coco Song from Italy. Eye exams by appointment, EYEDENTITY Eyewear, Albany.com. Nine Pin Cider, Albany, hard cider made from local apples. Tasting room features New York cider, beer, wine, spirits, Tuesday through Sunday, now available in Massachusetts and Connecticut, ninepincider.com. And Careers in Transition, LLC, Albany, Dr. Tom Denham, providing individual career guidance, career testing, job strategies, interview preparation, LinkedIn lessons, resume and cover letter writing, Careers in Transition, LLC.com. Thanks again to Bob Berman for being here. Thanks to Rob Chacon and Elizabeth Hill for engineering the program. We had two engineers today. No wonder it was so exciting. Deb Malik answered your calls. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, Anissa Wahid of Tara Kitchen returns with her Moroccan food favorites. Right now, stand by for news.